Hi, Carol joined.
Hi, it's John.
Hey, welcome, John.
Rick here, too.
Hey, Rick.
Hi, it's Dana Abernathy.
Hey, Dana, welcome.
Hi, thanks.
Is Deborah on? Okay. Let's wait like a minute or so, and then we'll sort of do another round robin of calls. And no, Stag's on the line, too. And I need to get a piece of paper and some pencils and stuff like that.
How many of y'all are coming down to Biltmore? Doesn't sound like anybody's coming to Biltmore.
I may be down there. Like I said earlier, I'm not sure how our spring's going to shape up just yet.
Okay. Somebody else just joined.
Stephanie.
Hey, Stephanie.
Hey.
Who joined?
Hi, Cheryl. It's Ann.
Hey, Ann. Welcome.
Anybody else? Yes.
Just a few.
Yes, a few. Okay, good.
By the way, if anybody is interested in a new horse, I know where there's a young bay Arab. Stephanie, I don't know if you've seen this one or not. It's different from the other one Janice told us
about. Janice hasn't?
Pardon?
One of Janice's?
Yes, it's not owned by Janice, but seriously, if anybody's interested, I'll send you pictures. It's a
3-year-old or something.
Two and a half year old. Will be three this year, but it was a late fall. And it's fairly closely related to, I think, both John's Heraldic and my Super. So,
Solitaire is the sire?
Pardon?
Solitaire is the sire?
Grandsire, I think.
Okay.
And the video looks just like Super looked when we first saw him when he was a youngster. So if anybody on the call is interested, email me and I'll send you the video and contact info.
So I've got Ann Stagg, John, Stephanie, Rick, Dana, myself. Anybody else? Ah, well, Deborah Richhead.
I think Barbara Hershberger was going to join in. She just may be late.
Yeah, and I don't want to necessarily have everybody. I know that John and Stagg have a call at 9.
Yeah. Yeah, so, we need to cut off by 9.
Yeah,
I would agree.
Exactly, so I will. Dana and Rick and Stephanie, why don't we do a bit of a round robin on more or less the topic or whatever else happens to wherever the conversation leads. We can do this one pretty open-ended because it's so few of us. It's an intimate conversation.
Intimate conversation, right?
Anyhow, Stephanie, let me start with you.
In what manner?
In so far as, do you have any particular issues, questions, vis-a-vis bringing along young horses or... just want to hear John expound upon it and ask questions.
I started one blindly and have muddled through it. Now he's a teenager and doing what my teenage son is doing and testing everything. So he's growing up.
It's just like a lot of things. It's kind of trying to find that happy medium between working too hard and too little and also between working too monotonous and too interesting. You know, in other words, so, you know, you've heard me talk so much about how most of our horses, our failures are based on getting into a cyclic pattern. You know, if their physical failures are getting into a cyclic pattern of doing too much of the same thing without these crucial little holidays. And many people worry about doing, say, an exercise or something that's too much for their young horse. And the reality is, I mean, most of our young horses can handle single feats of exercise much more than we give them credit for, you know, as far as what to do starting out, how to ramp them up. And what they can't handle is a program that starts off really ambitious and then gets grudgingly ambitious and sort of starts to accumulate problems. And that's really where you need to focus more, particularly when you're starting out a young horse on the physical aspects, is having a program that has enough stress to really be meaningful, but has enough break to not start the guy into this kind of a cyclic breakdown. And the big challenge with that becomes is that starts to say, well, I'll do a program that kind of works hard and rests extremely well and works hard and rests extremely well. And the trouble with a young horse is that's not necessarily the easiest way to manage their discipline in their mind, to go out, you know, occasionally and bust their chops and then put them up and let them get full of grain again. And so that's the challenge that we balance out here and are constantly adjusting how we approach each horse in the program and most of all trying to figure out new ways to sort of to more carefully evaluate how this horse is reacting, you know, to what we're doing with him, both mentally and physically. You're playing both at the same time, particularly with those young horses.
When you say young, is this just young in the sport, young in years, young in
Well, it's pretty much the same thing. If I say young, I probably mean young in experience.
Okay.
Because there's only a little bit of difference between a young horse, you know, of age and one that ages. That makes a small difference, but it's fairly small. But a young horse in experience, whether that be physical or his mental development, because it's experience that makes them mature horses. Within a few years, you know, difference.
Yeah, well, rather than have me go down the rat hole that I want to go down.
Okay.
Because I've got a rat hole.
We should go down some other rat holes first.
Well, let me, Rick, do you have any questions or things that you want to?
Well, how young would you break a horse?
Well, we like to have our horses just started and backed at two, but they're never seriously exercised until they're four.
Mm-hmm.
If there was something more I could afford to do in our own program, I'd have them doing quite a bit more exercise and schooling on lunge, on free in the ring, you know, and et cetera, as 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds before they're ridden.
Thank you. I have always heard that you're not to lunge horses, and I have lunged my horse since he was probably a year and a half to 2 years old, free lunging with other horses. And what I think it did was it developed good bone in his leg because it stressed him enough to get that new bone to lay down, but it didn't stress him in a way that would hurt anything.
Yeah, and it's also, if you really develop your skills well, it's also a wonderful time to educate in school and to ingrain good postures and good habits. And yes, I can understand how there are critics that will stand up and say, don't do this and don't do that, and oh, you can ruin them by doing this, and this makes them get this way and that makes them get this way. But I've also seen that in the hands of a true artist and a true experienced artist, nothing can possibly work better. And so we sort of have to endeavor to be that master of finesse and touch and skill and forgive ourselves if the first horse we try to develop that way isn't perfect, and we have to take a little extra time to correct some errors. You'll never reach real excellence unless you accept that you're going to do this and you'll endeavor to do it very well. And that's you can't even take for granted something like hanging a lunge line on a horse and just let him go around. And, you know, you have to learn to do it with a good eye and some judgment, because it's that opportunity to begin to guide and direct the path, the road they're first taking, and the way they move and the way they develop themselves.
I have a coming 3-year-old that I just had broke simply, I normally don't like break them that early, but I felt this guy needed the exercise mentally because he was a horse that was going to be a very dominant horse if he didn't learn manners and like that.
Yes, yes. That's, you know, the best endurance horses we have aren't the ones that sort of give their will freely, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to solve those things by one, having some skill, and B, just sort of managing the environment and the situations you allow you to get yourself in that don't exceed your skill set. Mm-hmm. And there's always a solution for everybody. The more important thing isn't the size of your tool chest; it's your ability to manage how you approach it, so you just don't get in a situation that requires a tool you don't own.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, with enough foresight about how you're approaching what's going on, anybody can come up with a good solution.
Who joined?
Deborah.
Hey, Deborah, welcome.
Thank you.
We're going to be a little bit expeditious tonight because John needs to. He's got a conflict at 9, as it turns out.
Okay.
ARC board call, unfortunately.
Rick, do you want to pursue that any further? Or?
No, not right now. Anyway, we'll
okay.
See how it flows here.
Yeah. Okay. I understand entirely. Dana?
Yeah. I actually. Kind of want to stick with that theme on the free lunging and kind of building the relationship and you know, I see so many people go off and just immediately start riding and training and doing all that, but I you know, for myself, I have a young horse that actually was a rescue, and he, I guess he's 4 now, and I find that, you know, I did a couple of rides with him last year, and I just didn't feel like his mind was there. So what I've done since is step back. But so when you kind of feel like you need to take that step back, mm-hmm. what are some of the fundamentals are you using, you know, just to kind of rebuild that relationship or start that relationship again? Is it a lot of the natural horsemanship, or?
I suppose, yeah. Particularly if, you know, if we have a horse that's in trouble, I send him to my cousin, who's kind of like the natural horsemanship guy,
mm-hmm.
and just to sort of delegate out some work because I can't do everything.
Yeah.
He gets most of our starters that really kind of need the behavioral start for us now.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's sort of based on just kind of fundamentals about how a horse perceives a relationship. So that he understands that not just that you're dominating him, but that the horse always needs to know that in his perception he has control simply by knowing that if he does this, you'll do that. You know? And it doesn't necessarily have to mean that he doesn't end up having to do what you want,
mm-hmm.
all the time, because your horse doesn't sort of dwell, his ego doesn't hang on what it is we ended up doing. In the end, he's completely content to have done exactly what you wanted, but he has to have a sense that if he does the right thing for you, you'll give him the peace he wants.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing how well you can build from that simple concept.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he just wants a peaceful experience. And it on the moment-by-moment basis, because his world is a world of milliseconds. Peace to him means he set his head down for you and you gave him peace that moment. And then he got another thought and it was the wrong one and you said no and you said it and he did the right thing and you said yes with peace. And I think where most of us humans fails is we have trouble developing the sort of the right kind of attentiveness and reflexive link to how the horse is or isn't behaving just the right way. Because if you have to concentrate on it too much, you're always kind of behind him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes the horse kind of that fall into being a calmer, more willing animal around you, and happier in the end. In the to him, in the for the horses, in the end, it's not what they're, you know, they don't care whether they're doing your bidding or not. They just sort of care that moment by moment they seem to know how the relate how the communication is working.
Yeah, Deborah, as John said that very well. Right. I have personal experience. Cheryl and I do because we also got a rescue horse 2 years ago from Amy Whalen that we actually think is a half brother of Super's, and we think he was going to go to the auction when Amy discovered him in this boarding stable because the border owners had disappeared and quit paying the bills. And when she actually got him, it was clear they'd quit feeding him for a while. We actually now think he was actually abused because we found out if you raised your hand around him in a certain way, it was like he would panic. So we think people were holding him on a lead line and, you know, beating him with a crop or something. And we did take him to natural horsemanship, you know, John Lyon type. You know, I did that with him. And then lots of in-hand groundwork, building up his confidence.
Mm-hmm.
We had some setbacks. But, you know, he was a horse who really kept signaling. He really wanted what John was saying. He wanted to trust you. You know, he wanted sort of to be your herd leader, but he wanted... But because of these experiences, he was always, you know, afraid of stepping over into that other world. And he's given me the best first two rides I've ever had. But it's taken, as John said, an awful lot of patience and time to get there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's important to notice that what constitutes abuse to a horse isn't necessarily what we normally imagine when we say the word abuse. And some of the most abused horses got that way by incidences that if the average person had looked at, they wouldn't have considered an abusive event.
Yeah.
But the horse perceived it the wrong way, and that was all that really mattered. So horses tend to act like they're shell-shocked. I've seen cases of horses that, you know, became totally shell-shocked, what you would label as an abused horse, based on a series of events that most of us would have dismissed. In other words, the person was not a very abusive natured person. The horse just basically lost confidence in the ability to communicate with you. And that's all it takes.
Can I paraphrase something just to make sure that I interpreted it correctly?
Yeah.
That I think you said, in effect, it's like the horse has to find that you really are predictable. In other words,
yes, that's
if
right.
The horse does something, you give
yes,
to the horse, or
that's
you
right.
don't give to the horse, as the case may be, but you
right.
give the horse the choice, and then the horse knows that, okay, if I do this, he's going to do that. If I do this other thing, he isn't, you know, one's nice and the other one's not so nice.
And that's right. And in the horse's world, that predictability is everything to his happiness.
Mm-hmm.
And the what you actually ended up having him do, no matter how much work or such it was, is not really of big consequence to it. But that feeling of predictability, the know how you'll react if he does this, you'll do that, and in that instant, you'll do that. That's important to him.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me run over to Deborah at this stage because.
My question is jumping ahead a little bit, but we do have two young horses at home now that were started under saddle last season, and they've kind of been walked down on the trail a lot. But how do you start conditioning them? Like, I mean, how much is appropriate for, say, a five-year-old?
For a five-year-old, and he's been ridden some occasionally out last year, some or
both got. They were both started last year, pretty much, and we did do a lot of groundwork and free lunging with them, and to gain their confidence, and they've been walked out on the trail, but they really haven't done any real, and I walk them uphill with their head down to try and start muscling their top line, but they haven't really done any conditioning yet. And I guess I've never started with a young horse like that before.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, the exact number varies a huge amount, depending on what time of year you're starting them, because they're all a little less fit winter and coming out of the winter.
Right.
Then they will be even by their own devices in 3 or 4 months from now.
Okay.
So be aware of that. But the truth is, like I said, many of these young horses, if they're of the stock and hardware to be an endurance horse at all, you might be surprised at just how much of an exercise it really takes to begin to matter as far as a training program. And the biggest key is to just know that you're getting home before you start to feel like you're having trouble, before they get fatigued enough for it to have changed their posture and their movement.
Okay.
You know, I know that's a good point. You know, in other words, particularly if you've developed your horse very nicely, he sets down on the bit very easily and lightly and rounds up well for you, he should never be ridden to the point where that's starting to be physically difficult for him.
Okay.
Where he just seems to have, where his posture starts to change. And you nearly want to ride as far as you can until that happens. But you want to try to avoid going over that edge to where he's coming home with his posture, where he's finishing his ride with his, where you've exceeded his ability to comfortably keep himself collected and move in somewhat the same posture he did as soon as he first warmed up and relaxed a little bit.
Okay.
And that could be 8 miles, that could be 15 miles for the first few rides. It kind of depends on your terrain and just where your horse is.
Okay.
But I try to be very sensitive to how his strength, particularly what I call his core strength, tends to be feeling throughout the event. And I want to gauge my workout so that I'm not over-challenging his core strength, because if he loses his posture, you're beginning to train him wrong. He's probably losing his attitude at the same moment, and he's making other physical stress risers in his body.
Okay.
So more and more as the years go, I'm sort of being more attentive to just how easy it is to keep the horse soft, round, and moving happily without a lot of urging, without a lot of driving him onto the bit, without feeling like I have to ask for a lot of new energy that wasn't there, that I didn't have to do in the first few miles.
Okay.
That's about the best rule of thumb that I can think of. When you're doing those first, what I call long, slow distance exercises, where we're going out and we're walking, we're trotting, there may even be a little bit of cantering to break up the monotony for short stretches when the choice is right. I'm not really on those first many months starting a young horse, I'm not really setting any exact fitness goals. You know, I'm just trying to make somewhat slightly progressive, more aggressive workouts, more aggressive rides, more moving out rides. But I deliberately don't go out with exact goals of distance or speed for several months. I know that I'm going to work a little bit more and more, but most of all, I'm just feeling out where that limit of this particular horse is before he might get too tired to have a good posture.
Okay.
And if I get away from home and I feel I'm losing it, I'm probably going to stop at a stream and we'll rest good for several minutes first.
Okay.
And keep him moving, bright and happy to get on along. You don't want to let him learn to ride given up physically, you know, and posturally.
Okay.
How much do you do alone the horse by without another equine companion?
A fair amount in my case. And occasionally, at least in this, you know, once in every, at least several dozen times in a young horses program, I'll have sections of rides, honestly, where I'll just go off through the woods off trail and just break trail, get off, walk around, actually just sort of, you know, explore with them.
Mm-hmm.
Just because I don't, A, I'm trying to have them exercised regularly and not particularly predictably.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want the young guy to get into this pattern right away that we're going to go do X workout. I don't want him to ever be able to anticipate exactly what it is we're going to do today. And so I may spend times where I just go out and ride some as much normally, like with a little bit of exercise in it, and then take a break from that and spend an hour exploring some corner of the forest where there's no trail. And just him walking behind me if I can't ride him through it. And do something interesting and then ride on back home. So that we're not caught in this pattern of he seems to, you know, getting to where he can predict what our workout is. That's difficult to avoid enough when you're starting to exercise them really heavy. And I sure don't want to start a young horse out thinking he knows all the score. Because it really only, unfortunately, the horse being able to anticipate what you're going to, they're the tremendous addicts for habit. And for him to even begin to anticipate what might be going on, is you'll never do it exactly as he expected enough. And it sort of makes a window and makes an opportunity for him to be dissatisfied. Whereas surprisingly enough, if you keep him continuously off his guard and having to ask you what's going on, it becomes a bonding experience.
Can we go back to Stephanie?
Well, if everybody's ready to progress, I'm through that baby starting stage.
Uh-huh.
Actually, like I said, have this 7 coming 8-year-old who's
okay. Yes.
Being a teenager, testing me, testing the herd. He's always been low in the herd, but you get him in free lunge with the other two horses that I work him with, and I'll
mm-hmm.
free lunge them all at the same time. Then he's competing for first place and testing me sometimes when I'm leading. I mean, he's just doing testing behaviors, which I like. I think it scared me last fall when he started that. I actually got him to a ride, and it was almost like his brain clicked on for the
mm-hmm.
first time, and I called Stag, and I was scared to death. I mean, I almost didn't start the horse at the national championship because he stood still when I was saddling him up, and he was, you know, just kind of waiting, and that got him in the herd, and he didn't start prancing around. He just kind of walked in a circle, and I honestly thought there was something wrong with the horse and couldn't
mm-hmm.
find anything. And it was almost like his brain clicked over,
mm-hmm.
and his whole work ethic, even on trail at home, changed from that point on. He wanted to work at that point, as opposed to, oh, let's, like you said, go out, let's go look at that rock over there, and, you know, we'll stop and picnic here a little bit, and, you know, well, I think I'll take a nap now and pull over to the side. I mean, he had a lazy streak in him until that point, and it clicked over. How do you keep challenging that when it clicks over?
It sounds wonderful, and I know exactly what you're saying, you know, and it is a good sign that your horse is reaching a maturity, and where he's ready to go on and train a bit harder. What was his last times and what distances?
Well, I took him to fits, and he was doing great, and we were running top half, and at 75 miles, I tied up, and I stopped, and he was vetting through all A's. He was at pulse when I'd bring him in, and basically we were pretty much hand galloping the whole way because I could not trot. I was laying on his neck.
Mm-hmm.
I got dehydrated and I couldn't ride anymore, so I stopped at 75 miles and running pretty good, and I took him through Gosey, the 75 miles, just to get him through. I don't know. I mean, he's running.
Yeah, it sounds like your horse
is running nice. I just don't know how to keep challenging him at this point.
Uh-huh. For one thing, I think he's ready. It sounds like if he got 75 miles down there and he got that good a score, he got all A's, he's probably ready to go ahead and move up more distance if that's where your goal is in the end anyway.
Right. He's done 100.
And all right, so
he was in the FEI 100. I just stopped. I couldn't do it.
Right. I understand. So, I mean, I think it sounds to me like you've got a horse within sight, you know, of going for the front on 100 on the next race.
Well, we're going to try Biltmore. I mean, the worst that can happen is I get pulled, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm willing to do that.
Uh-huh.
I'm not worried about that. I'm not real sure training wise if I'm doing the right thing, and I always question.
And the other
train
thing,
alone.
And the other good point, particularly when your horse says he's done 100 or so before,
mm-hmm.
but it's more vital and more important than ever to make sure that you pace your horse's first races, and particularly his first couple of attempts at any new distance, so that you're erring to the side of being able to give really strongly negative splits.
Okay.
I think it's really important to how your horse learns to regard what he's doing and how he sees the game. If you really instill upon him that if there's going to be any real effort you're putting out pace-wise, it's going to come later, and it's going to get progressive. We're going to do this progressively stronger.
Okay, and obviously I need to do splits like that in training.
What's that?
I need to do those splits like that in training.
Yeah,
obviously.
And that's true. And to some extent, your training should be more or less, like I said, not to the point of being absolutely predictable, as I was saying earlier, but they should be more or less, you know, exercises that start out, you know, medium or not that aggressive, and may do something interesting, not even related to training, in the middle for a bit, and then maybe some work. If there's any hard work, it comes in the latter part of it.
Okay.
And you want your horse to understand that the challenging part of these things comes late. And you never want him to be demoralized by finishing, you know, feeling tired out.
Right.
And it's particularly important there in those first races. I try to plan. You know, it's really important to me, no matter where it makes me end up placing, that the horse started and we progressively. Not if we didn't necessarily make exactly. You can't always in America, because our courses vary terrain wise so much, exactly make a negative split speed.
Right.
But I want to feel like it resembled a negative split's level of exertion.
Okay.
And particularly that I saved enough early that my horse came home feeling like he was gaining on people and eating them, you know, and finishing this thing like a champion. And he doesn't really count if there were two or three or four or five horses still ahead of him when he came across his finish line. His morale is dependent, or how he perceives his performance himself is dependent on how strong and how powerfully he came through those last leg or two.
Okay.
And so that's an important, you know, you want to make sure that your horse goes carefully enough in the beginning that he finishes like a real powerhouse with some vigor and a little excitement in the end. And that makes a horse that just gets, you know, he keeps his game
mm-hmm.
attitude.
Yeah. But Biltmore is a good course to practice that. It's awfully easy to go out too fast on the first.
That's right.
And many people do. And on the other hand, if you've got a fresh horse, the last 30 miles just invite moving out rapidly.
Yeah, matter of fact, that's exactly why you'll watch me. I tend to very much prefer to take my developing, less experienced horses to the harder races, to the harder courses, because the reality is they're no more or less pounding on your horse than doing, you know, the fast courses. But to have any kind of reasonable performance result at the end of a fast race like somewhere down in Florida or something like that, means that you're going to have to sort of play the pace just right all the way through from the start to the end. And you can go to a tougher race and significantly underride it in the beginning and put on a good, strong end and get yourself into a reasonable, good finishing position and still be able to assure yourself that you've got this stronger finish. And, you know, in other words, it doesn't cost you as much in the result to do what I said, you know, to make sure that you underride in the beginning and finish a strong ride. It won't cost you as much in the result on one of those tougher races as it will at a fast race where the thing's got to be so precisely paced the whole way.
Right.
To get a good result.
I think Steg did some statistics on a couple of years of Biltmore rides on riders that came into the vet check and, you know, the first 10 riders in. And the finish rate was not all that great amongst those riders.
You know, the overall, you know, the good point in, the sort of the quick summary of that work I did, and I think it's gotten a little bit better because people don't go out as fast because they heard me give this speech prior to doing that. If you were in the top 10 coming into the first checkpoint, you had a 20% chance of finishing, whereas the overall finishing rate in Biltmore is typically about 50%, I believe. Moreover, the winning rider never came from the first 10 into the checkpoint either of those 2 years. And in fact, some of the top riders frequently came, weren't even in the first 20 at the first checkpoint.
Right.
So, you know, that was very dramatic, you know, the difference between the people who went out fast versus the people who finished well.
It's very common at the Tevis for the first winner to not be in the first 40. I mean, the first person at the first vet check.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the at the first vet check, the winner to not be in the first 40.
Wow.
I know 1 year.
Now, Tevis has like 700 horses, too.
So. No, but it might have 200 horses.
Yeah.
But it, a typical, you know, typically in the Tevis, the winner is going to be somebody that's running in the late 20s to 30s.
Yeah.
At the first,
check.
The and I know at Biltmore, one of the years when Sue Greenall and I finished 1-2, we were in the bottom quartile, I think, crossing the Shenandoah River.
This is not Biltmore. This
I'm
is the
sorry,
yeah,
not, Old Dominion. One year. No, Old Dominion. Sue and I were, I think, in the bottom fourth of the ride. We certainly were in the bottom half crossing the Shenandoah River, which was 12.5 miles out.
Well, I think a lot of that's the difference between the technical course, which the OD and the Tevis and Biltmore definitely are, versus a ride in Florida, where to a certain extent, probably the first five riders stay the first five riders for most of the ride. Mm-hmm. They get their pace set, and they're going fast,
mm-hmm.
and they maintain it. You know, they have their horse trained to do that.
That's right.
Just observing, you know, Florida races in general, or flat races, whatever you want to call it. And I think that's true probably overseas in some cases.
Right.
The pace is going to be fast in those competitions, and, you know, it's not easy to come from behind.
Right.
But on a technical course, you definitely have the advantage.
Mm-hmm.
In doing so, for lameness reasons or whatever it may be, they're places you just shouldn't be hurrying through.
Right. And like I said, so that's the case, is the technical courses end up being the ones that being able to give that younger horse an environment where he actually sort of grows from it and improves by it, and you don't really completely have to make him look like a slouch in his performance to have given some priority to developing the horse.
Yeah, one comment, so to bring this back also to the young horse and get John to, I'll let John comment on how he does this, but I hear lots of riders say, well, I don't want to fight the horse early on. I'm going to waste all that energy fighting the horse. Mm-hmm. And I guess I've gotten very almost religious about, you know, that you've got to make that young horse listen early on, that
That's right.
To go at a very moderate pace. But, John, you might want to say more and also some of the tricks you use to make that happen.
No, and that's so very important. The truth is there is – you have to remember that there is no pace or plan or ride that you'll ever put. When you're riding a young horse and if he's being unruly and being hard-mouthed, well, you just have to be – you just have to be strong enough to admit to yourself that you've gotten yourself in a situation that's that you're not quite ready for just yet, and savvy enough to know that, you know what, the thing to do here is just to completely change what I'm doing, to step out of this, to step aside from the course and dismount a while, or just go home and say, you know what, I'm going to chalk this one up to experience. I shouldn't have been here yet. I wasn't quite ready. We'll go home. We learned what we need to know, and we'll go back to the drawing board for a while. Because if you're making a terrible fight of it, it's not solved by letting the horse run away. It's just made worse. And so you do what you have to make it a good learning experience, even if it ends up costing you this trip that you'd planned for and paid this big entry fee for. It's not as much a waste as if you let the horse have a bad learning experience with it. So even today, I'm not afraid to, if I feel like I've misunderstood how this horse would react and been surprised, it's not, the result of that race won't matter nearly as much as the opportunity to give the horse the right kind of experience.
Under circumstances, how do I phrase this properly? For the sake of argument, when we're starting our horses, we typically start them in a loose ring, snaffle, hollow mouth. And at the same time, we don't necessarily stay there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, what moves you to try different things? And what types of different things do you try in a progression? Ring thing can go away, and at the same time, I'm never quite sure why in the world we wind up where we do on some of these things.
You mean as far as equipment and a bit?
Yeah, and the concept of, okay, the young horse is, you've taken him to the ride, and it's not a good experience, and so you're enough with it that, okay, we're going to not do what we planned on doing today, we're going to do something different.
Yeah.
You salvage what you can, but then you go back and at home, and how do you regroup?
Well, you know, for instance, like, you know, we don't mind spending when we come back home and there's a problem, you know, we come across a behavior issue when we come to an event, and okay, he failed one section of the test, you know, is a bit about what it represents. Or at least the event has pointed out that that we've missed something in his career, in his educational program. And so we may literally just sort of go back through the very basic, you know, round pen treatment and whatnot. So we sort of try to notice what it is we missed about his relationship, you know, about how the way he sees communicating with us. And then as far as equipment, you know, there's always it doesn't matter too much fundamentally what different design or equipment or what kind of bit. The more I'm into it, the more I realize it really doesn't matter if you've got a piece of straw string or a barbed wire through his mouth. If it were in the right hands, it wouldn't matter. But what does matter is that for however that horse is behaving or whatever the environment and circumstances is, you're able to make it completely, that device or whatever it is, be it a bit or a piece of equipment on it, that you'll be able to make it completely quiet physically, so that it is able to give him a very crisp I'm giving you a signal now, I'm not giving you a signal now kind of situation. And one example that happened with me just last winter when I was riding Malika there at the President's Cup, for some reason or other, with the excitement or the stimulus she was getting in that environment for the first time, she kept throwing her tongue over top her bit. And so once it gets there, well, it's kind of giving her some discomfort all the time. And she kept doing this repeatedly. I don't know what got in her head that day. She kept putting her tongue over a bit, put her bit a little higher, trying to keep that, keep her from flipping her tongue over. She wouldn't do that. Got in the next vet check. I swapped around. I just put a, that was the first time in years I've given up on a snaffle, and I put a straight bit in her mouth just so she would sit quietly with it.
Mm-hmm.
And gave her something, you know, she couldn't play with and couldn't bend to get her tongue flipped over. She sat down on the bit quietly and rounded up beautifully without a lot of, you know, conversation about it from then on, and we had a beautiful ride. Hard to say what kind of, you know, environmental stimulus can, you know, can provoke what kind of strange response or behavior from your horse in some places, in some instances.
I'm half convinced I need to take my horse to rides all by himself, because he won't eat when he's under some circumstances when the other horses are at the ride, but they're not with him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, That's a... Okay. You should follow him around with the food.
Mm-hmm.
And about the third check, he decides, yeah, I guess I am hungry.
Mm-hmm.
Horses. Going back.
Yeah, and you know, and again, those longer rides tend to help develop all of those longer, tougher events, develop those self-preservation instincts a whole lot better than one that's in a big hairy. You take your horse to the Old Dominion or the, you know, or a ride that's going to have a complete, have a winning time of 14 or 15 hours, and you may ride your horse 16 or 17, even if he's a good young horse and fit. And by golly, a working day like that teaches them to remember to take care of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You end up instilling a lot of important, good, natural habits on your horse doing events like that. And multi-days are great that way, too.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, multi-day endurance rides, even through multi-day competitive trail rides, the longer, tougher endurance rides, they're the ones that develop, you know, the maturity and hone good instincts, of course.
I tend to lose sight of that. That's a good thought. Going back, Rick, your turn.
Rick there?
Somebody dropped
off. Sorry, I dropped off. It could have been Rick.
Yeah. Dana?
Well, I think, because I know we're getting short on time, but just when you start incorporating dressage, I've heard you all talk about dressage basics when you're working your horses or bringing them along. So do you start that in the beginning, or do you just kind of incorporate that all the way through, or and how much of that do you do on a weekly, monthly basis?
That's all the way through as far as I'm concerned, and never enough.
Mm-hmm.
It gets to be with me a little bigger priority all the time. It doesn't matter to me whether you call it dressage or just any sort of form of developing, you know, lighter, softer, higher educated communication. I'm really having a goal here to try and, you know, to get more of my horses to the level where, you know, as Becky pointed out, where we've got all of our horses, where I can ask for a fly and change in the straight, you know, where they're collected and soft and happy about it. And so that's kind of a little goal of mine, is where, you know, to where I can, you know, I'm getting a little better and a little better about having them be able to respond without question, you know, instinct, you know, reflexively to and ask for collection or whatnot, and to do it softly and whatnot. And I'm you know, as a goal, you know, none of us Americans have got our horses really as highly schooled as we really should before we go out into these races, you know, and start racing them. And to the extent that I, you know, are forever not quite as highly developed as I want to be before the horse is coming of age where the clock is ticking and he's got to get working or he just get too old, you know, we do move on somewhat anyway and finish up a little bit of the, you know, and keep developing the dressage schooling as we go. But I'm, you know, it is my own goal, you know, to get farther along in his schooling sooner all the time and figuring out ways to sort of be more efficient about how we progress at that without rushing them. Mm-hmm. While we mix in getting them physically fit. I'm getting more and more efficient about getting the horses physically fit all the time. Mm-hmm. So that's basically leaving more and more time to get them better schooled,
mm-hmm.
which sort of feeds on itself because then that helps make it more and more efficient to get them fit.
Yeah, makes sense.
And I think it provides a variety to your training program, too. You're just not always going to get on your horse, go out and trot around for
No, that's right. You know, as I keep saying, what breaks them down physically isn't the fact that we have too hard a workout or too tough a workout or too fast a workout. The speed only breaks them down if you're riding imperfectly.
Mm-hmm.
And the hard, the toughness and the length of the workouts only break them down if you do it too often.
Mm-hmm.
So that leaves a lot of windows in there where your horse's brain really should be exercised every day. And there's a lot of opportunities in between, you know, a workout schedule to have just spent some light days doing some schooling.
Mm-hmm. Breaks it up for them and you too.
Mm-hmm. It both breaks it up in the ways that it needs to be broken up, and it gives the horse a sense of regularity in his work
mm-hmm.
at the same time that he needs mentally.
Yeah, and it keeps his attention on you and your signals.
Keeps his attention on you, and he should never quite know whether this is a work day in the field, if this is a school day, or if there's a little bit of each.
Mm-hmm.
It's not uncommon for me to go out and exercise somewhere and have a little meadow out
mm-hmm.
in the forest somewhere that I'll stop and take a little schooling break.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think sometimes we're just so bent on, you know, building the aerobics and the
right
and the heart and lung and all that sort of thing that we kind of forget that there are all kinds of muscles in there that need developing.
And the gray matter is a big part of it.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things, at least in my experience with schooling, is as the horses start doing it, they don't necessarily see much point, but as they do more of it, they get into it.
Oh, that is true.
Mm-hmm.
The first lessons are the hardest ones because it seems like a futile, pointless thing, and you're just sort of asking them something just to be irritating. And then if you approach it with the right attitude, they eventually approach it with a fun attitude.
And I've noticed...
It's all in a matter of not challenging them so much that you don't have opportunities to say, that's great and thank you and here's your moment of peace.
Yeah.
If that is
take
happening.
Take a kick out of the calisthenics aspect of it as near as I can tell.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Like, see what I can do.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And all those little shoulder outs and stuff, you know, most of my guys know that they'll still before we really move out, you know, while somebody else is getting saddled and I'm waiting whoever I'm riding with, he's going around and he's doing a little bit of shoulder outs or something, you know, or backing around a corner. When we're doing shoulder outs, we're doing drills, because all these things both kind of engage their brain and limber them up. It's all part of the, it's all become part of the program that sort of, in other words, I've become relaxed enough in knowing that I'm going to hit my physical goals one way or t'other, you know, that I don't mind kind of having it a little bit mixed up as far as the horse's perception of it. That I'm not just hopping on them to say, oh, I've got to go so many miles in so many minutes on this program. That happens, but I know it's going to happen, and so I find, make sure that other things happen too.
Deborah? Are you still with us?
Really, John?
Sounds like we might have lost Deborah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Did anybody
almost?
Did somebody
it's
else,
almost 9 o'clock. Yeah.
Yeah. Did somebody else join in the meantime?
Peter Franklin.
Hey, Peter. Did you have any questions? Welcome.
Oh, thank you. Just listening with interest.
I'm here too.
Sandra's here too.
Hello.
Hi.
Good.
I find that dressage is very fatiguing on the horse. It does get their brain engaged as well as their hindquarters, but I find it's very strenuous on a horse. And I'm wondering how you evaluate the extra expenditure of energy versus the benefits.
I'm never really worried about the expenditure of energy, but I do want to feel like he's able to do it lightly and easily. You know, your dressage work or none of those exercises, like I spoke about when we first started the talk here. You know, it shouldn't feel like collecting is a labor. Like it's having to take a lot of energy. If you have that sense, then you've already worked a little harder than you should. It shouldn't ever be exercised to the extent in any workout that it feels like it's a physical labor. It should feel easy. That's the whole point. So, you know, much of this work is deliberate. Like, does not take very long. I don't try to make big gains in the schooling. If the horse makes any step of progress, any increment better than he's done before, that's where we stop. I'm not in such a hurry. That's why I end up not ever developing him, I guess, schooled quite as much as I'd like before they're a little more advanced and ready to do some endurance racing. But that's partly because I never want to have them pushing at their dressage, at their dancing, until it's, you know, to the extent that it's a physical strain and a big labor.
Do you feel it's advantageous to train the horse in dressage to develop their top line and musculature, but do you feel that while it can be advantageous because then they can carry weight better and more properly and not stress their hocks so much,
mm-hmm.
and not stress their front end so much particularly?
All right.
But your dressage develops the short twitch muscles, and are you more concerned with?
I don't.
A happy medium to
yeah.
Developing the short twitch versus a long twitch.
I don't think that it really does if you go about it carefully. Like I said, I'm not pushing. I never am pushing that toward to the extent where they're giving me bursts of strength.
Okay.
And our workouts. while their dressage workout might not be very long, I'm not pushing for bursts of strength. They're staying well within aerobics the whole time. Like I said, I think it's a mistake to take a horse and until the horse is going to be a dressage horse at higher levels, I don't think it's advantageous to push at it in a very physical form.
Right. Okay. That makes sense. So about how much do you want to keep a horse in a frame? Like, let's say you're going for an endurance race, and how much do you ride the horse in any kind of collection? And, of course, we're not talking Piaf and Passage collection. We're
no.
talking a moderate.
Mostly, I want to – it's just a matter of keeping them in a degree of collection that feels like their back is active. In other words, some signs, in other words, a horse is – that's appropriate for the terrain that he's on. And to that extent, it means that it has to be – he has to be responsive and willing to sort of take a cue for a little more and a little less at any given time. And collect it enough so that you feel like you're riding the whole body and that his back is both vertically and laterally active. If you, when I was in Canada, I had a nice, you know, video image of a couple of horses running along in the desert together. And you can pick out, I can point out, ask you to, you know, look at which one has a nice, seem to be springing back under the rider, because he's kind of using his whole body. And that's sort of the feeling that I'm looking for all the time, and just simply the fact that the horse is soft and responsive enough to my legs and to his mouth that he will respond a little more if I ask, you know, and will halt, and will come to a halt, you know, on, with all four wheels engaged, within a couple of strides, you know, a carefully digressing halt all the time that keep him engaged all the time. And whatever little level of collection that requires for that is enough. And to some extent that also to deal with, you know, to with a horse that's getting excited, say, at his first starts and stuff. He's got to have the communication channel has to stay open enough that you can keep him down and tell and direct to him where to put his attention. You know, even though he's very excited and would love to have his head up and Google eye at all the things that are scaring him and make the problem worse. So to some extent, you might see me in the beginning. That might be the one instance, you know, in the beginning of races, asking for a horse, you know, way more collected than is efficient or practical, simply because I'm overdoing it a little bit just to make sure that I'm keeping him busy and focused in the right place. In other words, if he's going to bubble up with energy, I'm not going to let him learn to vent it by running away. He'll vent it by giving me more animation under me and doing skills, you know, shoulder outs and this and that and extra things to do. And he'll let me vent where all this extra energy's got to go until he gets a grip on himself.
So how much training do you do collection versus just a long and low stride? And we're not, again, a moderate degree of collection, just the gymnastic frame versus kind of a long and low.
Yeah, you know, and
forehead set and.
Like I said, it can go, as far as I'm concerned, he can get a little longer and lower when he's relaxed enough to do that without dropping in the back.
Okay.
In other words, when he's truly relaxed and not anxious, you can sort of ease off on what you ask of him, let them find their own carriage on the terrain, and most intelligent horses know what's appropriate at that point. And so that's what I look for as soon as the horse relaxes to it. But just, again, you just want to make sure that something's not right, you know, if that makes a significant change, if you feel his back become inactive and dropped underneath of you. He should still want to retain that attitude and be carrying you. Even if you let go and let him have his head, long, low canter, or however he chooses.
Some are easier to train than others.
Oh, yes. Some of them get it more gifted than others.
Yeah.
Some of them we work a lot harder just to get stay close to the gifted ones.
Yeah.
That's the nature of this game. That's why they call it the sport of kings.
Very interesting.
I think we're going to have to wrap at this stage and let John go to his next call.
Oh, yes. I just realized here I'm a few minutes behind.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can stay on for a few more minutes because I don't have to be on for the hallway or see people just for the part that concerns the education committee.
Yeah.
Expert comments, John.
John,
okay.
Thank you again.
Thanks,
very, very
nice talking to you all.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, John. If anybody in the group wants to, you know, ask questions of each other or raise additional issues, we can go on for a few more minutes, or we can just wrap up now.
I'm good this evening.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Dana?
Yep, I'm good.
Rick?
Yeah, I'm fine.
Okay, Deborah? I think she dropped. Stephanie?
Yeah, I'm good. Yeah,
you did say him.
Yeah.
And Peter?
Yeah, I'm sorry I missed the first part, but the end of it was very worthwhile.
Okay, good. Thank you all very much.
Before we hang up, Stephanie, the group as a whole, you know, one idea occurred to me because of what Stephanie said tonight. Would there be worthwhile for a call on taking care of Ryder?
I think my thing was I went from 0 degrees here and went down to 80 degrees, and I could not hydrate enough. I mean, I could not keep enough fluids in me to make up. My body did not acclimate. It just did not. I mean, I felt bad starting at 40 miles.
Oh.
And at 75 miles, I said, I'm laying on my horse. I'm going to end up laming my horse.
Okay. I mean, one thing I do – maybe you already do this, but I mix a sports type thing. Right now I'm using something called FX, but you know, go to the sports people and I mix that in my Camelback, and I, you know, so I'm constantly sort of sipping a small amount of fluid while I'm on the trail, and it's not just water. It's, you know, the sports type drink.
With the possible exception of the last ride we did down at Red Barn, where you got so much.
You just had to open your mouth and.
Yeah, you stuck your tongue out, and it all happened.
But anyway, that's one tip. The other comment I'll make, Stephanie, actually to everybody, is you talked about your own experience going from cold to hot.
Mm-hmm.
Any of you ever take a horse from north to south, or winter to summer type climate, our horses go through a much bigger change than we do seasonally. In the winter, their capillary system retreats into their body so they conserve heat. Obviously, they get much hairier, etc. Even if you clip a horse, the horse is not ready for the hot weather. So.
Oh, I know. He spent the first 2 days down there standing, panting.
Yeah.
Just trying to acclimate. He actually adjusted fairly quickly, and I don't know if that's because being raised in Florida. I mean,
that can make a difference, but I do encourage people to be.
His first year was in Florida, first year and a half, till I got him at 18 months, he was in Florida.
Yeah, so one is you have to be very careful, and two, Stephanie, another very good point, there's some evidence, and we certainly, you know, in our small number of horses that we've had, we've seen this, that there are factors that get set in certain mammals in their first 6 months in life,
mm-hmm.
and the environment they're born into and never change. And that, I think that applies to horses. We had a big thoroughbred. I mean, this is a almost 1,300-pound thoroughbred who was a Florida thoroughbred.
Mm-hmm.
He handled heat beautifully, you know, even though he was a huge horse. Its skin, if you looked at it, he got scratched. We had a superbly bred Arab from the Rojaks that was born in April in Vermont. That horse never handled heat well. And so I think, in your case, Stephanie, probably Jake's being a Florida horse helped you, whereas, you know, if somebody gets a horse that's born in the middle of the winter from north, you may have a horse that is never going to be a heat horse.
Yeah, I mean, he really did not have an issue with it. And interestingly, I did not clip him going into that ride. I had clipped him going to Gosey. But because we were coming back into 0 degree, I mean, as we speak, it was 84 here yesterday, and it's snowing here right now.
Yeah.
And
sympathies. We're in about the same state.
Yeah. So crazy here right now, but I knew I was bringing him back into 0. So I thought, you know, if the heat starts bothering him, I can slow down. But interestingly, it never did. So he acclimated fairly quickly. I, on the other hand, just did not. I mean, it affected me from the get-go.
Oh, well. I was going to suggest, and Stag is sort of getting into this, if you've got topics for the next call, shoot me an email.
Okay.
We'll get somebody lined up to run with it, and want to thank you all again very much.
Okay. See you at Biltmore.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, Deborah, I did get your entries today. Take care, folks.
Uh-huh. Thank you. Bye-bye.
She'll have openings at Biltmore?
Yes. Yeah, there's still room at Biltmore, although it's starting to fill up now towards later. There's still room if you get your entries in quickly.
Okay.
Yeah, my wife is nodding and saying yes, and she's the ultimate source of information. Okay, well, hope to see a lot of you at Biltmore. Take care.
It's nice to see you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Don't.